for contribution of assets between an investor and its associate. Leonardo.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Agenda paper 12A describes a sweep issue identified by interested parties during the editorial review of the project sale or contribution of assets between an investor and its associate or joint venture. Amendments to IFRS 10 and IAS 28. In October, the ISB tentatively decided to finalize these amendments. The publication is expected in Q4 2014. The issue relates to the amendment to IFRS 10. The board decided to amend IFRS 10 so that when an entity loses control of a subsidiary that is not a business in a transaction with an associate or joint venture, the gain or loss recognized by the entity is limited to the unrelated investor interest in the associate or joint venture. Some reviewers asked the ISB to clarify how this amendment should be applied when a parent loses control of a subsidiary that is not a business but retains an interest in that former subsidiary that is accounted for using the equity method. The issue is whether the gain or loss related to the remeasurement at fair value of the retained interest in the former subsidiary should be recognized in full only to the extent of the unrelated investor interest in the former subsidiary or should not be recognized. An illustrative example of this issue is in paragraph 11 to 20 of the paper. We think that the gain or loss should be recognized only to the extent of the unrelated investor's interest in the former subsidiary, because this approach reflects the board decision to require that a partial gain should be recognized when the subsidiary is not a business. In our view, the board decided that when the subsidiary is not a business, the requirements of IAS 28 for a partial recognition of the gain should overcome the requirements of IFRS 10 for a full recognition of the gain. We agree that the draft wording of the amendment to IFRS 10 is not clear, so we think that the ISB should clarify the wording of paragraph B99A of IFRS 10. We ask the ISB members if they agree with our recommendation to clarify that the gain or loss resulting from the remeasurement at fair value of the investment retained in the former subsidiary should be recognized to the extent of a related investor's interest in that former subsidiary, and if they agree with our recommendation to confirm the finalization of the amendments to IFRS 10 as 28. Thank you.
Patricia.
View one in the paper asserts that the IASB's view is that loss of control of a subsidiary is a significant event and a gain should be recognized, even though the sub does not represent a business. And I think that's really the threshold question. Is this really our view? Even if the sub doesn't represent a business, do we believe a gain, full, partial, or no, should be recognized? So should an entity record a different gain or loss on the loss of control of an asset, depending on whether there's a holding company inserted into the transaction? And to me, the answer is no. And I was under the impression that the fundamental principle behind the amendment we were making was to ensure that if you disposed of an asset, regardless of the form of the transaction, you recognize the same gain. And therefore, I think I support view two because it comes to the answer that I believe is the correct gain. It's the same gain that the entity would have gotten if it had sold 48% of the asset to someone else directly without the entity in between. Not view three, although view three is worded in such a way that I support the word. So I'm very confused about the structure of the paper. But I think the fundamental principle should be that the gain on the transaction should be the same regardless of its form.
Could you explain just your last comment, that you like the wording but not the principle?
Well, I don't want to criticize Leonardo's drafting because this is a very difficult subject and somewhat convoluted, but U2 says the gain should be eliminated in full. And we're not eliminating the gain in full. We are going to recognize some gain. We would recognize the same gain that we would recognize if we'd sold the asset directly. So view three says the gain should be recognized to the extent of the unrelated investors' interests in the former subsidiary. To me, it's in the former asset because the subsidiary is in a business. So
I think I can explain Pat's last point. Pat, in paragraph 13, I think Leonardo is looking only at the revaluation of the retained interest in the sub/asset. This language is not about the recognition of the gain on the piece that was disposed.
But when you go through the examples, the gain in view three is 136, I think. And if they had sold 48% of the asset directly, the gain would have only been 96, which is the gain you get in view two example. And I think 96 is the right answer.
But again, I think in paragraph 13, this is only talking about the piece that was added to the 96.
Yeah.
It's not talking about the 96 itself. That's why the language is this way. So.
Right. So I support view two. No gain on the second piece, if we're clear about that.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask then, if you were to, so the second piece is this retained interest in the entity that used to be a subsidiary, is now an associate. How would you reconcile that with the guidance that we have in paragraph 25 of IFRS 10, which says, I think quite clearly, that when a parent loses control of subsidiary, then you measure the retained interest in that former subsidiary at fair value and you recognize the gain in the
interest. I thought the point of this amendment that we were working on was to reconcile that with a sale of an asset notion. And so it didn't, so I thought the idea was it didn't matter whether the asset was transferred directly or put into a holding company and transferred, the result should be the same.
That's right. And so we're saying...
But it's not. You get a different answer.
And we're saying that you shouldn't recognize the entire gain. Because there's not a business there, you should only recognize part of the gain. And that's what view three is.
But you're still recognizing part of the gain. So you're getting a bigger gain because the asset was put into a holding company and transferred than if it had been transferred directly.
Sure.
And I didn't think that was, to me that doesn't seem right. Maybe Tak has something to add.
Tak.
Yes, I 100% agree with what Pat said. The part of this amendment, I thought, was we should make a clear distinction between the business contained one or non-business one. So in the case we do not have business, then we treat it as if we own, as if the entity owns the asset directly. So if that is the heart of this amendment, then I don't think the view three is the right answer. So actually, having said that, this contains the very fundamental amendment to the IFRS 10. And I don't know whether we had enough discussion, whether we meant that far, or we only talked about just mechanical elimination issue. If we discussed only just the elimination issue, then this issue must be discussed a little bit further within our board. Or we could make a decision now, but this is a very fundamental issue.
Oh, thank you. The analysis is very nice to understand the issue, so thank you for your effort. But I suggest view one rather than view three. The reason is quite similar to Pat and Tak, but
two reasons. The first reason is that if we apply Rule 3, the final number of investment is 78 based on this example. That number 78 has no meaning at all, because that 78 is different from the fair value 120 and the book value cost 40. So 78 is a kind of a partial number, has no economic meaning at all. So view three is a kind of a, that's why I'm saying this is not a good approach. And another thing, why I prefer view one rather than view two is if we lose our control, as you explained in view one, it's a new event, then maybe we need to give a fair value of investment retained in maybe not anymore. But if we provide good information, the fair value might be a good idea. That's why I'm suggesting view one rather than view three. And
well, I think this illustrates that we have put ourselves in a rather difficult situation with having two extremes. If you sell a subsidiary which is a business, you take the profit in full. If you sell something which is not a business, only an asset, you take no profit at all. And if you are in between, and this is a tension, what does constitute a business or not? So just you want to add a little bit more to this asset, put a little bit with it to make it a business, then you have all the profit. And I think structuring opportunities will be huge in organizing transactions if you want to have profit or if you don't want to have profit. This being said, it doesn't have much to resolve the issue, but I think we have to recognize that we have a difficult starting point. It's time that we align the treatment of sale of the asset with sale of a business, I think.
So Pat would say we should align the sale of the asset with the sale of the company. So you're saying we should align the sale of the business.
I'm saying, like Pat, that having a different accounting, whether I put this asset into a legal structure, as we propose, here is easy. I have an asset, a building. Depending on how much profit I want to make on the transaction. By the way, it's a transaction with an associate, so it's quite easy to organize. Even though I don't control the associate, I can have some form of agreement because of my significant influence over that element. So I take this asset, this building, I sell it directly to this associate, no profit. I put something around it, like some staff, some customer relationship, and I make it a business, then I take profit in full. Or I can, in between, put it in a legal structure that I create ad hoc, and then I sell a subsidiary, which has only that asset, which is an asset, and I take the profit, view three, only to the extent of my unrelated interest, which is in between the two extremes. Well,
Which one do you go for?
I think I would accept view three, but recognizing that we have a very serious situation where the tension on what creates a business, what constitutes a business, is huge because of the effect.
Mary?
I am a variant of view two, but the first thing, the reason I say variant is this is the outcome I want, but rather than saying the gain is eliminated in full, I think it's that you don't recognize a gain because you don't revalue a retained interest in an associate. But what I wanted to do is step back first and say, thanks to the staff, because they took the time to bring this back as a sweep issue rather than just saying let's ignore it or it's just going to slow things down. And I think it's good in terms of bottoming out what our principle is, and you know, in this amendment, even if it's painful. I thought, like Pat, that the driver of this amendment more generally, rather than this issue, was that the requirements for business don't apply. Just because, you know, if an entity is a sub with, you know, that's not a business, therefore you don't therefore you are subject to the limitation on gain recognition when you sell to an entity to which you apply equity method, you know, the main driver. But I think the extension of that would go to, and you don't revalue retained interest. So that's to me how it hangs together. But I think the most important thing in this is that we be clear about what the consequences of our decision are. So I think it's good that the staff brought it back. I think it's good that we spell out what our conclusion is and how the principle applies. I just have a preference about which one it would be.
Gary?
I actually support the staff's view. And Leo and I, we plotted through a couple of the big firms, you know, guidance about, you know, the decision charts when you get different positions and change them. And that would come out with at least a couple of the big firms, at least their U.S. books. I do agree with Philippe and Mary, I think, and some others that this is a fundamental issue about, you know, if it's a business, non-business, or what do you do with remeasurement. But I think those are more strategic issues as opposed to a sweep issue in an amendment. And I think the decision now is, does this clarify enough issues in practice, you know, in the short term? Because I think gain or loss on business versus non-business and remeasurement, I think those are big questions. They're going to take a while to answer should we choose to answer them. And so I think, assuming we want a tactical answer to a question that's on the table on amendment, I think view three is right.
Martin?
I'm also supporting the staff's view because I think it is consistent with the decision which we have made and really differentiating between if it is a business or not a business, then we have a different outcome. And if we apply this, what we have decided, I think C is really the right answer and we should go forward with that. And I think, okay, if we want to change really what we think, okay, if we selling a business or not a business and have different outcome, and if you are not fine with that, I think we have to change that overall. But that is more fundamental. But I think that is in line with what we have decided and what is our objective.
Amar?
I think it's aligned with Martin's. When we did this, I had the same position as Patricia. I think what makes sense to me is view two, because of the same reasons Patricia has expressed. But I do understand why the staff prefers view three and aligned with paragraph B99A and making the analogy of the application of the paragraph to this very much this very situation. So at the same time, I agree this is not an easy issue if we decided to open it and go and explore more. So my question to the staff would be, what do you, if we at the end of the day have a preference for view two, what do you envisage of as additional work that has to be done to finalize this?
Amara, are you view two or view three?
I prefer view two as the result that makes sense to me, but I understand what view three, the position of the staff on view three, because it's analogizing to what we've decided in B99. So I'm just wondering what the staff's perception of additional work would be necessary for us if we do decide for view three because it makes sense.
View three is, as we've set out in the paper, what we think the logical conclusion is of applying the past board decisions to this particular transaction, which is why we recommended it. If the board was to decide that view three is not what they want to see the outcome to be as a consequence of this amendment, then I think the first step for us would be to bring back a paper which sets out the consequences of that decision to see, well, what new inconsistencies would we be creating if we didn't go with view three. As I say, we think that view three is entirely consistent with the past decisions. If you disagree with that, then I think we need to check to see what additional inconsistency we would be creating if we didn't go with view three.
Which are likely to be considerable.
We'd need to do the analysis first, I think.
It's hard to think it wouldn't be considerable. The role of remeasurement and partial ownership and changes in it, I think, would take a while to get through it.
Yeah. Well, I suppose nobody is extremely enthusiastic, but who can live with a staff's recommendation?
That's 11.
Okay. suppose we put in the back of our mind that in the future some work needs to be done on this.
Yes.
Issue. Does this also answer question two as well? Oh yes, Leonard is already done.
Gotta move fast.
Take the money and run, Leonardo. Okay, 12B.
Yes. The purpose of agenda paper 12B is to explain the steps in the due process that the ISB has taken before the publication of the exposure draft proposed amendments to IS 28 with regard to elimination of gains from downstream transactions. As you see pages 4 and 5 of this paper, I have included four questions to the board. First question is about dissenting. When the ISB discussed this issue at the July 2013 meeting, one board member voted against it. So my question is, do any other board members dissent to the publication of the proposed amendment? And second question is about timetable. We will start the balloting process in February and publish the exposure draft in March. Does the board agree with the proposed timetable? And third question is about comment period. We propose a minimum standard comment period of 120 days. Does the board agree with the proposed comment period? And my last question is about due process steps, which are summarized in Appendix B of this paper. Is the ISB satisfied that all required due process steps have been complied with? Thank you.
Yeah, I will dissent, and I already passed the alternative view. I disagree to induce the rule-based mechanical requirement to require unexplainable deferred gain. I think circumstance makes the situation. I mean, I don't think there are lots of situations that investor of associate need to recognize liability further to its investment. It totally depends on the circumstances. Normally, associates have a parent company. Normally, associates is a subsidiary of consolidated group of other companies. So then transactions, downstream transactions with that associates, economically same as the transaction with that consolidated group. In that case, normally, investors do not have to recognize liability. But introducing such a mechanical rule and force them to recognize the liability, no matter what the circumstances. So I disagree with the proposal. So I will dissent.
Okay. Any other dissenters? No.
So yes, our next questions then are connected with the timetable and the comment period.
Okay.
Okay. And then the due process.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The objective of staff paper 12C is to address two SWIP issues identified by two ISB members during the balloting process for the project accounting for acquisitions of interest in joint operations. After reviewing the draft amendments to IFRS 11 in the course of the balloting process and analyzing the comments from an editorial review, the ISB members think that the amendments to IFRS 11 should be also be addressed. Deferring to issues should also be addressed. Does a joint operator remeasure previously held interest in a joint operation on the acquisition of an additional interest in the same joint operation? whilst retaining joint control in circumstances in which the activity of the joint operation constitutes a business as defined in IVRS 3. And the second issue is, does do the amendments to IVRS 11 apply on the acquisition of an interest in a joint operation under common control? We analyzed the issues and agree with the ISB members raising the issues that the amendments to IVRS 11 should first clarify that previously held interests in a joint operation are not remeasured on the acquisition of an additional interest in the same joint operation while retaining joint control. Without such a clarification, it might be unclear that the amendments to IVRS 11 refer to the principle in paragraph 23 of IVRS 10 instead of the principle in paragraph 42 of IVRS 3 for such situations, and consequently previously held interests in a joint operation are not remeasured. And on the second issue, a scope exclusion should be added to the amendments to IVRS 11 in respect of the acquisition of an interest in a joint operation in which the activity constitutes a business when the parties sharing joint control, including the reporting entity, are under common control of the same ultimate controlling party. We should not require the application of the principles business combinations accounting for transaction that would be outside the scope of IVRS 3 if control rather than joint control would be obtained by the acquirer. This is our view on that. So consequently, we want to ask the following questions to the ISB. First of all, does the ISB agree with the staff recommendation to clarify that previously held interests in a joint operation are not remeasured on the acquisition of an additional interest in the same joint operation if the acquisition results in retaining joint control?
Agreed?
Yes.
Thank you. Second question. Does the ISB agree with the staff's recommendation to include a scope exception for acquisitions of interest in joint operations under common control in the amendments to IVRS 11?
Yes.
And the final, first and final question, does the ISB agree with the staff's recommendation to confirm the finalization of the amendments to IVRS 11?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Well done.